Hey, welcome everybody to Bio 231, your human anatomy lecture. Today is Monday, June 22nd, and we're going to move into the integumentary system today after we finish up some things on histology. So let's take a quick look at the schedule. I'm going to turn some of these lights down so you all can see real nice. Here is the schedule. Right here, the 22nd. Ooh, last day to drop without a W. Okay, that's noteworthy. And then we're going to get into integumentary system. Tomorrow we have a lecture on bones and skeletal tissue, and even that lecture tomorrow is going to be on the test on Wednesday. So lecture Monday, lecture Tuesday, test, your first test on Wednesday the 24th. And that's going to cover chapters 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. It's not going to include chapter number 3. So I would go ahead and look at all of those weekly assignments that we have in Blackboard, or I have in Blackboard for you to look at, practice questions, right, those online questions. The study guides tell you what figures I like within each of those chapters that I might photocopy, put on the test. Gives you a list of the questions at the end of the chapter that I like, which I might put on the test, and also those online practice questions. Right, there's a list there of which ones I like, and some of those I might put on the test as well. So there's a lot of practice you can have before you take the test on Wednesday. All right, and then on Thursday is your first practicum. We got a couple labs, three labs before that first practicum, which is going to be plenty of time. All right, so does anybody have a question on the schedule? Let's think a second. What do you need for the test on Wednesday? What do you want to bring to class? What do you have to bring? Scantron, I like Scantron. Pencil. Eraser, fantastic eraser. Check it out before you come. Make sure it works, okay? Not just a smudger. All right, and I think, yeah, picture ID. One more thing, right? Your picture ID. Please bring all that. And then I'll grade the tests before lab, and probably in lab you can even look them over. Okay, I'll show you your tests. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the schedule. So we were talking about histology last time, and so I'm just wondering, does anybody have any questions regarding histology so far, what we talked about? Y'all are pretty good? Okay. Okay, I don't see any hands out there. We talked about glands. What kind of tissue makes glands up? Can you remember what kind of tissue makes glands? Tissue. Oh, I tell you what, let's start even more fundamental than that. How many major kinds of tissues are there in the body? Yeah, there's four, right? So you should be really familiar with that. And then the four, you should know them to be epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. Hopefully you can say it just as easily as I did, right? Because that will help you out on the test. And a gland is made up of one of those four kind of tissues. So can anybody remember which kind it is? Yeah, it is epithelium. Epithelium makes most glands. I don't know what the percentage is, but it might be 90%, 95%, something like that. But a large percentage is made up of epithelial tissue. And we characterize glands into some major categories. The first one that we looked at, right, is this one right here. Who can tell me what the name of this cell is? It's a goblet cell, and its job is to synthesize mucus, which is a protein modified by a sugar molecule, right, modified by the Golgi apparatus right here. Protein comes from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and then here are a bunch of vesicles containing mucus that gets secreted onto the apical surface of this goblet cell, and it just lines the surface of whatever this goblet cell is in. Could be a trachea, could be digestive tract, could be stomach, something like that. So that mucus is kind of sticky, it's a lubricant, but it's also a really tough protein. So it's a really nice barrier that protects the stomach, for instance, and the rest of the digestive tract from being digested by all the material that's in the stomach and the small intestine. So mucus is good. It has another function that we'll look at when we get into the reproductive system. This is what we call a unicellular gland, right? Just a single cell. most glands in our body, we would want to consider them as multicellular. So we can characterize multicellular glands into two major types. What are the two major types? I don't have it on the slide right here. Maybe I should put it up here. Okay. I heard something I liked a lot. Endocrine and exocrine. Okay, what's the difference between the two? Ducts. One has ducts. I like that. Which one has ducts? The one that has a duct is an exocrine gland, and the one that doesn't have a duct is an endocrine gland. And an endocrine gland doesn't need a duct because why? Why doesn't an endocrine gland need a duct? It produces a product, secretes it outside the cell, and then how does that product get to where it's supposed to go? By the blood. That's right. So endocrine gland doesn't need a duct because it uses the circulatory system to carry that product everywhere in the body. Okay? And for an endocrine gland, do you know what the name of that product is that gets secreted into the blood? That is a hormone. That's right. And probably know the names of some hormones. We'll look at some hormones in here, physiology, look at them, even probably some more. And so that hormone then goes all over the body, but it doesn't signal every single cell in your body to change its physiology. Right? What cells in your body can respond to a hormone that's in the blood? It's a certain kind of tissue. It's called a target tissue. And what makes a target tissue special compared to any other tissue in the body for that one particular hormone? It's got to have a receptor. That's right. So a target tissue has a receptor for that particular hormone, and then it can respond to that particular signal. All right, so that's just a little review of glands. Hopefully that made a lot of sense to you, because that's coming up in just a couple days. All right, so that's epithelium, some parts of epithelium. Connective tissue. We looked at all these different kinds of connective tissues in lab, except for, I think, all of them pretty much. Let me just go and take a quick look and run through some of these slides anyway. All right, as I'm finding that slide, think back to epithelium. And a cell or a epithelium has two main layers. What's a good way to think of the main layers in an epithelium? I'm not showing you this on the slide right now. What are the two main surfaces on an epithelium? There's a basal surface that's connected to the basement membrane, and then there's the apical surface, which is connected to some free space, maybe the inside of a tube or the outside of your body, right? And the cell membrane looks a lot different in either of those two locations, right? And it's the job of the nucleus to make sure that those apical surfaces and basal surfaces are different. They have different structures in them, different kinds of proteins. Now, here's a really good concept. Since the apical surface and basal surface of those epithelial cells have different structures in the membranes, what can you tell me about the function of the apical surface compared to the basal surface? Yeah, the take-home message there is that they are going to be different, and we're going to maybe look at some of those differences, right? You change the anatomy, change the structure of something, then you change the function. All right, so I think you looked at this slide that I'm showing you on the right-hand side in lab. This is a pretty typical slide of cartilage. Right, there are little bubbles within the matrix, and I don't see any fibers in this particular kind of connective tissue. Nonetheless, okay, it has this ground substance. The space between the cells is called the, it says right here, matrix, right? So that's a connective tissue. Cells are far apart. Here's a cell that's in this little bubble. The bubble is called a lacuna. And the cell, right, what's the name of a cartilage cell? Yeah, site means cell, and chondro means cartilage, right? So here is a cartilage cell or chondrocyte. If we look at the next slide, now in the matrix I can see some fibers. These are thin, highly branched fibers, characteristic of elastic fibers. So here is something we call elastic cartilage. Ah, but what kind of tissue is elastic cartilage? Is it epithelium, connective, muscle, or nervous tissue? Connective, yeah. So always tell me what kind of tissue it is so that I know you know that it's a connective tissue, right? Don't, on a practicum, don't say elastic cartilage muscle because it's not such a thing, right? Okay. And then here is, the next slide is the toughest kind of cartilage. Again, I can see lacunae, I can see chondrocytes on the inside. Now I see a lot of thick filaments, and this is the strongest filament. Who knows the name of that protein that makes this filament that's the strongest one of the ones we looked at so far? It is collagen. Yeah, if you said collagen, that's fantastic. So this makes a really strong kind of cartilage, like the cartilage in the intervertebral discs. That would be a good place, right? Fibrocartilage. All right, and then, it's not labeled on your slide, but I do want you to know this. Here is a really nice characteristic picture of bone. I see what circles inside circles inside circles, which really means that there's what, tubes inside tubes inside tubes. This is a cross section, so they look like circles. And these dark dots are lacunae, and there's a cell inside these lacunae. And you got to know the name of this cell. Even in lab, you have to know the name of this cell. So in your notes or on the slide, if you have a picture of this slide, go ahead and write the name of this cell down. Could it be a chondrocyte? No, because it's not cartilage, right? And what is kind of the coin term, the coin word for bone? Yeah, osteo, osseous. Anytime you hear that word osteo, it's referring to bone. So these are osteocytes, osteocytes. So bone is definitely a living tissue because it has these living cells in there. And what kind of tissue is a bone tissue? It's connective tissue. Yeah, it's connective tissue. All right, here's that funny one. Oh yeah, I remember now talking about this one in lab. It connects all different parts of your body because it can flow from one region to another. So here is blood, and what kind of tissue is blood? It's CT, yeah, it's a connective tissue. Right here I see some leukocytes, one with this highly lobed nucleus. That's a neutrophil. Here's one with just a nice spherical nucleus, that's a lymphocyte. These that don't have nuclei are red blood cells. Anybody know a name for, another name for red blood cell? Well, there's a Latin word for red, and that is erythro. So these are erythrocytes. And then this little guy right here is not a white blood cell, but looks different than a red blood cell. That's a platelet or thrombocyte. All right, so those are some good connective tissues. And let's start to find something about muscle tissue. All right, so we're done with connective muscle tissue. So here is a kind of muscle. And why is it obvious this is a kind of muscle? Because all these striations, right? It just jumps out at you, might even get you dizzy a little bit, right? These are what we call striations. That these striations show up because of the internal machines that are inside a muscle cell that cause it to contract. And so a muscle is specialized to contract or to shorten. This particular cell is long and linear, and they all have many nuclei. So here's a cell with 1, 2, 3, 4 nuclei, because at one point in time, there were many, many muscle cells that joined together to form this long fiber. And each of those nuclei still resides in that resulting fiber that was produced. Here's an illustration, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So here's kind of a funny cell that has, that is multinucleate, and that's because it came from many cells. All right, do you remember a cell that doesn't have any nucleus in it? Anybody remember a cell that didn't have any nucleus in it? Maybe look back at that last slide I showed you. Goblet cell has a nucleus. And you know, a goblet cell has to have a nucleus because it's making a lot of protein. So it needs to get information from the nucleus on how to make that protein. So mucus is part protein, so a goblet cell needs a nucleus. But there was one cell that we looked at that's filled with a compound called hemoglobin that's responsible for transporting blood, oxygen in your body everywhere. So there's no room for a nucleus inside that cell. And you didn't see it on that previous slide. How far do I have to go back? Too far. Right there. Which was a red blood cell or erythrocyte. All right, so there's some cells that are pretty strange because they're multinucleate, some cells that are kind of strange because they don't have any. Most cells in your body have one. Okay, so that's why this is kind of strange. This is called skeletal muscle, long linear fibers. And who can tell me why it's called skeletal muscle? Because it's attached to bones or your skeleton and it moves your skeleton around, right? So that's the job. And if you wanted to stand up right now and go to lab, would you be able to do that? Yeah, under just your own conscious thought, right? So this kind of muscle obeys your conscious commands, conscious thoughts, so we call it voluntary muscle. And you know, here's something that's really scary, actually. Of everything that makes up your body, the only thing you have conscious control of is skeletal muscle. Everything else is taken care of automatically for you, right? Except your thoughts, but that's more complicated than just some physiology. Skeletal muscle makes up about 40% of most people's body weight. And we see it has many nuclei, voluntary control, striated. And there is an animal that's made up of 98 or 99% flight muscle. Almost 100% flight muscle. So they can fly around really easy. Anybody think of what kind of animal can fly around really, really easy? Can fly up and down, sideways, backwards, forth. And it's called a dragonfly. A dragonfly, mostly flight muscle, right? Because all the rest of the parts of their body are just so light, like their wings are hardly weigh anything at all. So would that be, I think that'd be cool to be made up of 95 to 100% muscle. That would be great. Probably wouldn't be very smart. But anyway, it would be fun to jump around, right? Could be a really great athlete. All right, that's skeletal muscle. Next kind of muscle. Do you see something that's similar on this slide? Yeah, striation. So the internal machinery is the same as skeletal muscle, but now, right, I see a branching pattern, and this is cardiac muscle. It is involuntary. You can't control your heart, and the cells are really short, and this thing right here called an intercalated disc glues the cells together so that when the heart contracts, these cells don't pull apart. And that would be terrible if they did, because then you'd have a big hole in your heart. Cardiac muscle. And then the last kind, smooth muscle, there's something missing right here. There are no striations. So the way that this muscle contracts, or the machines inside this muscle, are a lot different compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. We'll take a look at those. And this is under involuntary control as well. All right, so we find smooth muscles in the walls of hollow organs inside your body, like the gastrointestinal tract, urinary bladder, ureters, that's part of your urinary system, and reproductive system, and many more places. All right, so that's muscle. Anybody got a question on muscle? Went through it kind of fast. Okay, so the science sheet is moving around. Moving around, moving around. The last kind of tissue we're going to look at in here is nervous tissue. And what do we see about nervous tissue? Two main kinds of cells. There are something that we call neurons and something we call neuroglia or neuroglial cells. Neurons are responsible for transmitting electrical impulses, which have information associated with them, long distances, very rapidly. So neurons can, from your brain, can get down to your little toe rapidly and cause it to contract. So that's the job of a neuron. Neuroglia cell, on the other hand, doesn't send information in the form of electrical impulses, but they help protect these neurons and supply them with nutrients, get rid of waste products, and other kinds of things that we'll look at. We call them a support cell. So they're not for sending information, but they just help the neurons do their job. All right, so what the heck does a neuron look like? What does a neuron look like? Let's see if I have one over here. Okay, I sure don't. Oh yeah, fantastic. A neuron, one of the two types of nervous system cells, has got three main areas. There is something that contains the nucleus, we call that the cell body, and it contains most of the cytoplasm as well. This is the part of the cell that can make proteins, right, and control the activity in the rest of the cell. And here is an illustration of a typical kind of neuron. And this right here is the cell body, because what do I see right smack in the middle of this thing? Yeah, the nucleus, right? So that's the cell body. Then I see some projections coming off the cell body. These short ones that are highly branched, these are called dendrites. This is the receiving end of a neuron. You could think of these as like little antennae that you'd maybe have on a TV set or a radio. Has anybody ever seen an antenna on a TV set? No, probably not. Well, okay. I had antennas when I was growing up, even on radios and things like that. Maybe if you have a radio clock in your bathroom, it might have an antenna on it still. Okay, so this is the receiving end. That's a dendrite. And then this one really long projection, a projection off of the main body of something, sometimes is what we call a process. Bones have processes, right? So dendrites are processes. They're short and branched. This other process, really long, and only one of them, that's called an axon. And the axon is the sending part of a neuron. This is what travels really long distances, like from your spinal cord all the way to some muscle for innervation. So here is a neuron. And here I see some examples of real neurons. I don't even see the dendrites on this particular neuron. They're too small to see. And then here is that nice thick axon that's going someplace. So it looks a lot different than most kinds of cells. Membranes. Anybody got a question on any of the types of tissues? Epithelium, connective, muscle, nervous tissue. Those are the main kinds. So you should be able to recognize what these cells are by their name, and then figure out what kind of tissue they belong to. So if we're going to think of a membrane, right, it's a thin sheet or layer that covers a structure, maybe lines a cavity, that almost sounds like an epithelium. But a membrane also has another component. It has connective tissue, loose connective tissue or areolar connective tissue with it. And so this membrane can line something, but it can also connect things to each other, like the basement membrane connects that epithelium with connective tissue underneath it. And when you think of a membrane, you should think of two main kinds. And there's some other kinds that aren't really so special, don't fit into these categories. But here are the two main kinds, a mucous membrane and a serous membrane. So let's look and see what the main difference is between these two different kinds of membranes. I don't like that. What do I like? This one? Oh, I like this one. Okay, so here's a really nice slide, and I can see an oral cavity. Okay, and I can see the trachea, and here's the nasal cavity. Now, is this oral cavity open to the outside world? Can you easily get from the outside world to the inside of your mouth? Absolutely, right? So the membrane that lines your oral cavity is called a mucous membrane, because that's the definition. Mucous membrane is open to a cavity, or it's a cavity that's open to the outside world. Nasal cavity, open to the outside world. Oral cavity, even the trachea, that's open to the outside world. So that's a mucous membrane. Your digestive tract, here's an esophagus. Since it's open to the outside world, that has a mucous membrane. And all the components, all the parts of your digestive tract, since it's open to the outside world, has a mucous membrane. And a mucous membrane maybe secretes mucus, but that's may, and some don't. Okay, so your oral cavity doesn't secrete mucus. I think that's probably a pretty good thing. Trachea does. Digestive tract does. Okay, so that's a mucous membrane, just one single layer. And it's shown in this nice gold color or yellow color right here. That represents a nice mucous membrane. All right, the second kind of membrane is called a serous membrane. A serous membrane lines a cavity that is not open to the outside world. So here's the inside of the lung, right? So this is deep inside your body. There's a membrane around the outside of the lung. On the inside, since it's open to the outside world, the inside has a mucous membrane. But on the surface of the lung, that's not open to the outside world. It has a serous membrane. Let's take a look at this serous membrane. You see two layers? There's one layer right on the surface of the lung, and then there's a space, and then there's another part that is lining the outside where the lung really doesn't touch. This is the wall of the thorax, or wall of the pleural cavity. So those are the three main parts of a serous membrane. Let's zoom in maybe a little bit more over here, like so. Maybe a little bit too much. Right on. So here's that lung. Right on the surface of the lung is one part of the serous membrane. That's called the visceral division because the lung is a visceral organ, an organ deep inside a body cavity. Right. And then here's that serous space cavity, and it's filled with serous fluid. And then touching the wall of the thorax, this is the parietal division of this serous membrane. So the divisions are, right, from deep to superficial, it's going to be visceral, the serous space, and then parietal division of that serous membrane. And here is the heart. The heart's in a cavity. Who can tell me what cavity the heart is in? Yeah, the pericardial cavity, the smallest cavity that the heart is in. And so there's a serous membrane around it because the pericardial cavity is not open to the outside world. So here is the pericardial membrane on the surface of the heart. Go ahead, tell me, what's the name of this membrane right on the surface of the heart?
Visceral.
I like that. Visceral pericardium, right? And then here's that pericardial space. And then here's the membrane that makes up the wall of the pericardium. It doesn't touch the heart. This is the most superficial. Go ahead and tell me the name of this membrane right here. The parietal pericardium, right? So you got visceral, the space, and then the parietal part of the pericardium. All right. Also, besides the lungs and the heart, right, since the abdominal cavity is not open to the outside world, it's got a serous membrane associated with it as well. And here is the abdominal cavity. Here's the pelvic cavity. Here are some organs that are inside the abdominal cavity, like stomach, right, and some intestines. And so here is part of the peritoneal membrane. It's touching this organ. So this is the visceral. And if we trace it, here's another visceral because it's touching this organ right here. And if we follow it around, guess where it goes? Up against the wall of the abdominal cavity. So once it's up against the wall of the abdominal cavity, can't call it the visceral peritoneum. This has got to be the parietal peritoneum, right? So visceral on the surface, parietal on the body wall, and in between is that serous cavity filled with serous fluid. Okay. All right, so those are the two main kinds. There are some other kinds that sometimes we group together as just other, like your skin. We're going to call that the cutaneous membrane. We're going to look at that in the next chapter, but it's a stratified squamous epithelium, and it's got some connective tissue underneath in the dermis, for instance. We drew that on the board. There, when you have a joint that's movable, it has a cavity called the synovial cavity. That's what helps like make your elbow work and your shoulder work. There is another membrane, okay, that surrounds a bone on the outside. That's called the periosteum. So if you look at this word periosteum, do you have a clue or a hint that it refers to bone?
Yeah.
Why is that? What do you see? Osteo, that's right. Anytime you hear osteo, you should think of bone. Peri means surrounding the outside. Endosteum, again, what does it refer to? What kind of tissue? Endosteum, bone. And endo means on the inside. Right, so there are hollow cavities inside bones sometimes, and those cavities are lined with a membrane that's called the endosteum. All right, so that's it for histology. What's the tricky thing here? Make sure you know the three divisions of a serous membrane. Visceral, serous space, and then the parietal division. Okay. All right, so I'm going to put some of these things away. And we're going to move over to the next topic. Okay, which is? Integumentary system. All right, so tell me what the integumentary system is. In your own words, what's the integumentary system? Yeah, skin. That's nice. Skin, 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 skin. Where are my skin slides? Here they are. Put them over here. Okay, so here is, we just took out a tube out of somebody's skin, enlarged it so that we can see what's going on in skin. This is typically what skin looks like. It has a whole bunch of components, but skin in your body might not look exactly like this, right? But if we were to take everything everywhere in your body and stick it into this example, then it has everything, almost everything that we want to look at, right? So just remember that cell that we looked at had all of the organelles, but there might not be a cell anywhere in your body that has all those organelles. It was just an illustration to help you see what some of those organelles were like. All right, so what is the integumentary system? Well, it's skin. That's one of the things. And the skin has two main layers from lab. Can you remember what the two main layers of skin are? Epidermis. Maybe that's what you said. Or maybe you said dermis. I couldn't quite hear. Which one is the most superficial? Epidermis or dermis? Yeah, epidermis. Epi means on top of, right? So epidermis is on top of the dermis. So that's part of the integumentary system. But there are other things that make it up. Hair, we call these accessory structures. Hair, nails, glands, and there's even some muscle in skin. Now this muscle in skin is smooth muscle. You can't control it because skin is not a bone, so it can't be skeletal muscle. So let's think of some of the functions of skin. It protects internal structures inside your body, like muscles and bones, from bacteria and viruses, so it prevents infection. It's a very important barrier to prevent infection. And it's also like a magic saran wrap. It also is a permeability barrier so that you do not dry out, right? So you don't dehydrate or desiccate. And without skin, you would dehydrate in just a matter of minutes and turn into a potato chip, and that just wouldn't be good, right? So your skin is really, really important. It also helps regulate body temperature. So for instance, if we all got up, started running around the room, up the stairs, down the stairs, up the stairs 10 times, our body temperature would increase. And how would you know by looking at your skin that your body temperature increased because of that exercise? Yeah, you'd start sweating, right? So that's how your skin helps regulate body temperature when you heat up, right? So you sweat, that water evaporates, that carries heat away from your body. But when you're cold, it helps regulate your body temperature too because blood vessels going to the skin close off, right? And so blood doesn't go to the skin where it would cool down. It stays deep inside your body, maintaining the heat inside your body. So temperature regulation is important. It also helps produce a vitamin that we need. A vitamin is a compound that our body cannot produce. It can't synthesize it, right? It's got to get it, you got to get it from your dietary source, and that is vitamin D. You consume a precursor to vitamin D. That precursor goes to the skin, and then it's converted into an active form of vitamin D. Does anybody have an idea what vitamin D is good for? Vitamin D is really important. What's it good for? Okay, vitamin D is necessary so that we can absorb calcium from our diet. Our body can't make calcium. We have to consume it, but it can't get from our digestive tract into our body unless there's vitamin D. Does anybody have a reason why we want calcium in our body? Bones makes bones strong. That's right. And sometimes as we get older, our bones lose calcium. They get weaker and brittle. Very prevalent kind of pathological condition is more than abnormal. It can be really pathological. Who knows what that condition's called as we get older? Osteoporosis, that's right. Everybody, if you're lucky enough to live long enough, will have osteoporosis. And a person that starts off in life with thinner bones, right, is more susceptible. And it just so happens women have thinner bones than men. So women are a little bit more, actually a lot more susceptible to osteoporosis. But if you're a woman that has really nice strong bones, you're not as susceptible. okay, to osteoporosis. But nonetheless, you still need vitamin D. That helps you protect yourself from osteoporosis later in life. And then another function of skin is sensation. All right, so what have you felt today on your skin? Have you felt anything? Probably a lot of stuff, but you didn't pay attention to it because it happens all the time to you. Okay. What have you felt on your skin? Anybody feel anything on your skin today? Oh, yeah, if you're outside, maybe you felt the warmth of the sun, right? So temperature. When you put your clothes on, right, you could feel those clothes going over your body. And probably with your eyes closed, when you put your pants on, you could tell if you put your left leg in first or your right leg because you would feel those sensations on your leg, right? Okay. So a lot of different kinds of sensations. Temperature, touch, vibration, these are all sensations that can that go to the level of your consciousness. All right, so now we can start looking at some of the anatomy of the skin. Remember, two main layers, epidermis and dermis. Epi is a superficial layer. It's an epithelium, stratified squamous epithelium with four or five different layers depending on where we see that skin. And then the dermis, right? Is connective tissue, and it has two main layers, a papillary layer that's superficial, and then a reticular layer that is a little bit deep. And then there's another layer, which we talk about with skin, it's called hypodermis, or the subcutaneous tissue. This is not really part of your skin, but since it lies right underneath the skin, this is where we talk about it. Right? Don't say too much about it. It is loose areolar connective tissue. It helps attach your skin, your epidermis and dermis, to structures like bones and muscles. So it's important. And it stores fat. And as a matter of fact, somebody might store as much as half of their body fat in this subcutaneous region or hypodermis. What do you think hypo means? What do you think hypo means? Here's a clue. Epi means on top. Hypo means underneath, right? So let's take a look at this slide. And let me just see. Okay, fantastic. Okay, let's look at the slide on the right. This shows us some skin. And here is a layer that's kind of yellow. This is hypodermis. It's adipose connective tissue, which is an areolar, a loose kind of connective tissue, right? So it's adipose connective tissue. This is not really part of the skin. Right, superficial fascia or hypodermis. Then right above it is the dermis. And remember the two layers of the dermis. The top layer is the papillary layer because it helps make up these papillae, these little wavy lines right here. The dermis pokes up into the epidermis. And then this layer is the reticular layer. It has a really strong fiber that we call collagen in it. Right? And that's where leather products come from. So that's the dermis. If we look at the dermis, I see that there are some nerve fibers that go up into the dermis for pain sensation, for temperature sensation. These are free nerve endings. And then there's some special receptors like this Pacinian corpuscle. Pacinian corpuscle is what we call lamellar because it has all of these different layers. All right, so a lamellated or a lamellar receptor has a lot of layers, and maybe that reminds me of a vegetable. I think we can call it a vegetable. What kind of vegetable does that remind you of? This Pacinian corpuscle, or lamellar corpuscle. Corpuscle just means a little circle of something. How about an onion? Anybody ever open up an onion, and when you look on the inside, you see a lot of layers in that onion? Right. And then here's that muscle that we talked about. This is an erector pili or arrector pili muscle. And it's not connected to bone, so it's not a skeletal muscle. It's a smooth muscle. It's connected to the most superficial part of the dermis and then to a hair follicle. So when it contracts, it helps pull that hair follicle up out of the dermis up to the surface. Right, and a lot of times these hairs kind of lay down on the surface of the skin, but when this arrector pili contracts, it straightens the hair up so it points straight up off the surface of the skin. Like for instance, under kinds of emotional conditions, experiences, right, these little muscles contract, right? And when you're cold, they contract, and when it tries to push the skin out, right, it forms a little bump right here on the surface of the skin that we call a, not a fingerprint, it's a, yeah, we call that a goose bump or goose pimple sometimes, right, due to this erector pili muscle. Okay, and then I also see some glands. Here is a sweat gland, an eccrine sweat gland, and here is a duct that goes to the surface of the skin. So if this is a gland that has a duct, what kind of gland is that? It is an exocrine gland. Yeah. Okay, and then here's another gland. This is a sebaceous gland. It secretes sebum, right, onto the shaft of this hair follicle, or this hair that's growing outside of your body, and it acts like a lubricant. So sebaceous glands are always, here's another sebaceous gland. A sebaceous gland is only found within a hair follicle. Okay, within a hair follicle. And there's another kind of gland, which you'll see in lab. I don't have a picture of it here. All right, so we see, okay, we see all the layers, epidermis and dermis. And these little bumps right here are called papillae. Oh, and look at this papillae right here. Oh, this is even a better one. Here's a papillae, and guess what I see? I see a blood vessel there. And that's probably one of the most important reasons why these papillae are there, because these blood vessels then can project up into the epidermis. And remember, the epidermis is an epithelium. And epithelium always is missing something. What does it never have? It never has blood vessels, right? And in order to stay alive, you need all those nutrients that are in blood. So the subpapillary vascular plexus, okay, right here, is just the way to bring blood vessels as close as possible to major areas of the epidermis, because it doesn't have blood vessels itself. Okay, that's called the subpapillary vascular plexus. And then here is a pore, dermal pore. Okay, so that's a pretty good overview of skin. And someplace I have a video lecture on skin, probably on my website, which you can go and watch. Okay. All right, so let's look at the epidermis, which is this first layer. So epidermis starts here and moves all the way down to here. All right, so when you look at this expanse of this tissue right here, do you see anything that looks like layers? You see anything that kind of looks like layers right here? Yeah, right? Here is a really dark layer, then not so dark, then here's a light one, and then there's another dark one right here. So the epidermis definitely has layers. And so what kind of epithelium is this if it has many layers? It's stratified, right? And these cells on the top are going to be flat, like almost what I see right here. So this is the epidermis is a stratified squamous epithelium. It's designed to rub off your body. That's fine. We call that abrasion. When you rub up against something, that's abrasion. These cells just rub off your body, okay, and that's what it's supposed to do, because the cells down over here are undergoing mitosis. They replace the ones that rub off, right? So your skin is being regenerated all the time. All right, so let's take a look and see what kind of layers we see. Here is a really nice exam figure. So if we look at this layer, or this region within that picture of the skin we looked at, and zoom into it, this is what we see, right? So here is a dermal papillae that's poking up, can't quite see it, right? So here is part of the dermis, and then from here to here is the epidermis, and then I can begin to see some layers. The very deepest layer, that's called the stratum basale. That's the layer that's undergoing mitosis, right? So it is the most proliferative. It is proliferating. So how do you proliferate? You have a parent cell split into two daughter cells, right? That's what we call proliferation. When a tissue or a layer grows, it's proliferating. There's also a sensory receptor in this part of the epidermis, right? We're going to call this a Merkel's disc. Well, it's not labeled on this slide. Merkel's disc, I'm sure it's in your notes someplace. Okay. And here is another cell. And it would be really nice. The cell kind of looks pink or something to me, kind of a strange color. But it would be really nice if the cell was a brown color, or maybe black. Does it look brown? Does it look brown? Not at all. Okay. And this is a melanocyte. And I see it has many processes or projections that go between the rest of the cells of the skin. A melanocyte produces a pigment that we call melanin. And so this is called a melanocyte. It's actually a nerve cell that has migrated away from the nervous system and embedded itself in the skin. And who knows what a pigment is? What's a pigment? What's a pigment? The chairs have a pigment. What does a pigment confer to something? Paint has pigments in it. Nail polish has pigments in it.
Color.
Yeah, it makes color, right? So it's a particular chemical, and white light has all different kinds of colors, the whole color of the rainbow, right? Red and green and yellow, purple, indigo. And what a pigment does is that it absorbs some of those different colors of light, but there's one kind of color that it doesn't absorb, and it reflects it back to where light came from. Okay, so these chairs right here have a yellow pigment in them. The yellow pigment absorbs the blue and the green and the red, but it doesn't absorb the yellow, and that's what gets shined back to your eye. So that's a pigment, right? So a blue paint absorbs everything except the color blue, and then you can see that because it reflects off of that. This melanocyte right here is really, really dark. It absorbs all different colors of the rainbow, including ultraviolet light that we can't see. And so the job of this melanocyte is to protect the deeper layers of the skin, like the dermis, from the harmful effects of the sun. Sunlight is very damaging to skin. All right, so that is a melanocyte. Produces melanin, protects the skin, that's its job. And what do you think one of the most damaging things you can do to your skin is? What's one of the most damaging? It will age your skin rapidly. And that is? Oh, a tanning booth. Yeah, a tanning booth, because a tanning booth is acting like the sun, right? It has a lot of harmful rays in it. And so actually just going outside in sunlight is really one of the most damaging things you can do to your skin without protection, without wearing a hat or sunscreen, right? But the more melanocytes you have, the darker your skin is, the more you are protected, and the longer in your life your skin will look nice and new and healthy as well, because you have that natural sunscreen. You know, if you live in a place of the world that's really close to the equator, like Australia, if you go look at people in Australia walking around outside, you'll never see them without a hat, right? Because they're always being protected from the sun, just to prevent their ears from getting cancer, their nose from getting cancer. It's something that we kind of take for granted in the United States because we're a little bit far away from the equator. But it's always a good thing to do to protect yourself from sunlight, believe it or not. Okay. All right, so that is the stratum basale. Right, it's got these Merkel's discs, it's got melanocytes, cells are undergoing mitosis. And then they move up to this next region, the stratum spinosum. And I can see some connections between cells. These are called desmosomes. These cells start to shrink down. They start to lose a little bit of water, but the desmosomes are still there. And so that produces a lot of points on these cells. So it's the spiny layer. Right, so that's what's happening right here. And these cells now start to make a chemical which can be easily confused with collagen, right? Because it's strong. It gives skin its strength. So where do you find collagen? And what kind of tissue is it? What kind of tissue is collagen in? It's connective tissue, right? And where in that connective tissue do we find collagen? Is it inside the cell or outside the cell? Yeah, it's in the matrix. It's outside the cell. Collagen is outside the cell. The chemical that makes skin cells strong is called keratin. And it is not outside the cell, it is inside. So it's intracellular. Keratin is intracellular. And so the stratum spinosum is where these cells start to make some precursors to keratin. And since these cells are all making keratin, sometimes we call them keratinocytes. Right? Keratinocytes or skin cells are the same because they're making keratin. Right. In the stratum basale, I see another cell that has a bunch of projections or processes all over the place going in between the cells, in between the keratinocytes. This is an immune cell. It kind of should remind you of a white blood cell. And it can crawl around a little bit, but not too fast, because these cells are all close to, all these keratinocytes are very close together and they're glued together. This is called a dendritic cell. Kind of reminded somebody, all these processes kind of reminded somebody of dendrites coming off of a neuron, a dendritic cell. It's also called a Langerhans cell. So let's see, Langerhans, oh yeah, here do I have it? Langerhans, right, that's in your notes, Langerhans. So it looks for things that don't belong in your skin, like viruses, bacteria, fungus, even tumor cells. Right? Hopefully it can recognize a tumor cell, and when it recognizes one of those cells, it kills it. That's its job, to prevent infection. All right, so that's the stratum spinosum. The next superficial one, if you look really close, you're going to see a bunch of granules inside this particular cell. And those granules, right, are made up of something called keratohyalin. And keratohyalin is like a glue. It's a very sticky kind of substance, and it's going to glue all the keratin molecules once they mature together inside the cell, and that's what makes the cell really strong. Right? And the stratum granulosum also secretes a lipid on the outside of the cell, right? And that's really important. What can you tell me about oil and water? Oil and water. Do they like each other? No. They just don't mix, right? So oil is a barrier. Water can't get through oil. So these cells of the stratum granulosum secrete oil between the cells, and that prevents water inside your body from evaporating out. That prevents dehydration. All right, so that's another important reason for the stratum granulosum. All right, and then they move up into the next layer right here, and they're really far away from blood vessels and the dermal papillae, so these cells in this last layer are dead because they can't get oxygen, can't get nutrients, but they're all set up already. They're loaded with keratin, right? And in between the cells, there's that lipid, and so it's a nice saran wrap on your body. We call this the stratum corneum. A cornified cell is a cell that's dead, loaded with keratin. Right, and that these are pretty tough cells, and the shape of these cells up over here are flat. So this is a nice stratified squamous epithelium. So those are the layers in a kind of skin that we call thin skin. Thin skin is what we have pretty much all over our body except for a couple locations. Yeah, question. Say again. Oh, proliferate. Yeah, no, you pronounced it just right. It was just an echo. I couldn't quite hear. Yeah, proliferation is when you have a cell that's growing via mitosis, right? So instead of one cell, then you get two, then four, then eight, and 16. So there's a rapid growth of cells. That's what proliferation means. All right, so if you have some area in your body, it has one cell, and you come back the next day, it can have thousands of cells in that one particular area. We call that proliferation. All right, and that's kind of a nice landmark of tumor cells and cancer cells. They're proliferating. They're growing very rapidly. A cancer cell grows uncontrollably. It produces so many cells. Okay. All right, so here is that melanocyte. It comes from the nervous system, so it's a cell that likes to migrate. And sometimes it turns cancerous and starts to proliferate or grow uncontrollably, right? And when you ever have a tissue that's growing uncontrollably, we call that a tumor. But this melanocyte not only produces a tumor, we call it cancer, because this cell, remember, likes to migrate around inside your body because that's where it came from, right? Even those tumor cells then like to break away from the skin and go to other places, like the brain and bones and liver, and then form new tumors in those areas, right? And so that's what cancer is. And we call that process metastasis. And that's just one of the basic natures of a melanocyte. So that's a really dangerous kind of cancer to have, because these cells just love to move around in all different places in your body. Okay? That's one of the reasons why it's a dangerous kind of cancer to have. All right, and a really easy way to damage this melanocyte is by going into sunlight. Right? And so that is kind of ironic, because what's the job of this melanocyte? It gets damaged when you go into sunlight. Too bright a sun day after day after day can turn cancerous. And that's ironic, because why is this melanocyte there? It's supposed to protect you from sunlight. Okay, so that's why I consider that an irony. All right, so that is the epidermis. So this is thin skin. Another kind of skin that we have, right, is going to be found on the palms of your hands, soles of your feet. And that's what we call thick skin. It's a lot tougher. And it also has some other characteristics. Okay, if you touch something with your fingertip, right, and remove your finger, like a window or something, and you look at the window, what can you see sometimes? Your fingerprints, right? So thick skin also has fingerprints. Your toes and feet, right, palms of your hands have fingerprints. And so let's take a look at that. So here is a nice cross-section of thick skin. I see this area. So dermis goes from here to here, right? And then from here above is what we call the epidermis. So here's the stratum basale. And look at these dermal papillae. They're very large. They're very deep. That's characteristic of the thick skin. And these ridges right here made by these dermal papillae usually project up to the surface of the skin, and it's what gives, that's the basis for fingerprints, these dermal papillae right here. All right, so do you see all this collagen? All the collagen in the deep layer of the dermis, we call that the reticular layer. Not so much collagen in that superficial layer of the dermis, but I do see these papillae, so this is what we call the papillary layer. Okay, so let's concentrate on the epidermis. Here's the stratum basale right here. The next layer is going to be the stratum spinosum. And then here's stratum granulosum. We saw the little granules. And then thick skin has one additional layer. And I see it right here. Right? And sometimes, like right here, it's very clear. It doesn't pick up a lot of stain. And another word for clear is lucid. If you're speaking very clearly, you're speaking lucidly. Right? So this is called the stratum lucidum. It's found only in thick skin. And then superficial to the stratum lucidum is the layer that we're familiar with. That's the stratum corneum. And look at the stratum corneum. What would be one way you could characterize the stratum corneum? Is it thick or is it thin? Thick or thin? It's a very deep layer. Many, many, many cells on top of each other. And so that's why we call this thick skin, because the stratum corneum is very extensive in thick skin. All right, so those are some of the layers, right? Okay, we went over that in lab, but we'll draw it on the board one more time. You got a nice video where you can draw these different layers out. And maybe in lab I'm going to show you something. Okay, a lot of times students get a little flustered when they see an organ with a lot of layers in it, because you got to know something about all those layers. But it's really important to know the layers, because that's how disease within this particular organ is diagnosed, right? What layer is involved, okay? And it's also a way to stage that disease process, right? So if it's just one layer, that's not so bad. If there's more than one layer, that's not as good. Right, and if there's like four or five layers that are involved with some kind of pathological process or cancer, then that's a very advanced form of cancer. And once it's diagnosed, then you have a way of maybe trying to treat it. Right, so by knowing the layers and what is happening in those layers is a way to come up with a diagnosis. And before you can treat something, you have to have a diagnosis. Right, and you get all of that by looking at the layers, the involvement of all these different layers. So really important to know something about all these different layers. Okay, the dermis. I think we kind of looked at the dermis already. Pretty much. Actually, this slide right here. Superficial layer of the dermis is papillary. The deeper layer has a lot of collagen. Call that the reticular layer. All right, so the reticular layer is dense irregular CT, and the superficial layer is areolar connective tissue. Areolar is not as strong because it doesn't have collagen in it. Okay, skin color. Right, there are different kinds of color skin can be. I don't have pictures of these things, but you know it would be a good idea if I did. All right, well, skin color could be due to a couple kinds of things. It could be due to blood, right, that maybe you can see through the skin. If somebody has a really light-colored skin, you can see blood vessels right through it, and that will give skin what kind of color? I'm going to have to trust you on this. Like your lips, okay? Your lips look different color to me than the rest of your face. What kind of color do your lips look like? Uh-oh. You never looked at anybody's lips, and the lights are almost turned off, so you can't see. But how about pink or red? Okay, I would guess pink or red. All right, I know when people put on lipstick, they put on like red type stuff, right? Okay, all right, so blood can give skin a color, like a reddish or pinkish color, and then there can be other pigments, right? The chemicals that can absorb light. Now, blood, when it's oxygenated, looks red. When it's low in oxygen, when it's deoxygenated, doesn't look so red, looks a little bit more blue. So skin could have a red color or a blue color depending on the condition of your blood. And so it might be a nice way to determine what's happening with your blood. All right, so let's take a look at some of these pigments. All right, melanin, natural sunscreen, right? It's brown to black in color. And what kind of cell produces melanin? It is a melanocyte. Remember, cyte is cell. All right, so melanocytes produce melanin. Oh, in what layer are melanocytes found? It's right there. It's going to go away. Quick, find it. It's in the stratum basale. Right, stratum basale. Moles or age spots are an increased number of melanocytes in a particular area, so you might have a little dot someplace on your skin that's a little bit darker. Freckles are increased melanin, all right, maybe not as dark as a mole. Albinism, right, is when an individual, it could be a human, could be many other kinds of animals, they have melanocytes that can't produce melanin. These cells are missing the enzyme to make the final conversion into the chemical that turns really, really dark. And so, you can't catch this. This is inherited, right? And it's congenital. Either you have albinism or you don't, right from birth. And since you don't produce melanin, somebody with albinism, do you think they're very sensitive to sunlight or not so sensitive? Very sensitive, right? Remember, the lighter your skin color is, the more damaging sunlight is, and if you have no melanin whatsoever, sunlight is very damaging. And somebody with albinism can burn their skin probably in a minute or two, maybe even less than a minute. Right? So that's how important that melanin is. And so somebody with albinism is going to look, completely white. And it doesn't matter what their what background they're from, right? People from Africa will look completely like white. They'll have the same characteristics of somebody from Africa, but be completely white. And that happens to animals too, right? There can be deer that are completely white or squirrels that are completely white. I know when I grew up in Illinois, there was a town that had a whole bunch of white squirrels. That was pretty cool running around, and that's because that condition is inherited. All right, cyanosis, another kind of condition. This is when somebody's skin color looks blue. So cyanosis is blue, and that's because blood is not oxygenated. And so that's a really important sign. that something is wrong with that person's body. Maybe their heart isn't working. Maybe there's some holes in the heart or some blood vessels that aren't working or the lungs aren't functioning properly. Right? Their skin will have a blue cast to that. And as a matter of fact, as soon as you're born, there's somebody there looking at your skin color and they're looking for this cyanotic condition. Right? And so that's just an indication of respiratory distress in a newborn baby. And that helps enter a score for a newborn baby. Everybody's given a score as soon as you're born to kind of quickly assess the viability of that infant, because it's a very kind of dangerous time. You can lose an infant pretty quickly. Does anybody know what that score is called? Yeah, it's an Apgar score, right? And so they look at skin color, they look at reflexes, and things like that, add all this stuff up together, and I think the maximum is 5. So probably all of us here were a 5 at one time. 5 is good. That's like the maximum score. Okay, jaundice is when somebody looks yellow instead of blue. Okay, jaundice could be due to a liver failure. It could be due to a bunch of breakdown of red blood cells. And again, an infant can look jaundiced. They can look yellow, right, if there was an immune imbalance between the fetus and the mom during development. And that can be really dangerous. The chemical that produces jaundice is called bilirubin, and bilirubin is really toxic to developing nervous systems. And so that's a really serious condition as well. Okay, so jaundice is yellow. Sometimes when somebody has liver cancer, or maybe they're getting chemotherapy for a certain kind of cancer in their body and it attacks the liver, then they will become jaundiced as well. And if you look at the whites of their eyes, even if they have really dark skin color, look at the whites of their eyes, guess what? They're not white. What color would they be? A yellow, startling yellow color, kind of a bright yellow color. Okay. All right, so that's some skin color. Let's look at some. We go, what, to 9:30? Yes, we do. Accessory skin structures, like hair. All right, let's see if I can find some hair someplace. Here. Okay, so here is the hair follicle, and here's that arrector pili muscle attached to it. Here's that sebaceous gland. And here is the hair bulb right in this region. And hair is really part of the epidermis. Right? So the shaft of a hair is the part of this hair that's above the surface of the skin. And this hair shaft right here, and even the hair root, right, that's going down to the bulb, these are made of keratinocytes. Right, just regular kind of skin cells. And of course, hair can have a color, right? And that color comes from melanocytes. And compared to the rest of your skin, what is hair like? Is it tougher or not as tough? Or kind of the same? Do you think hair is tough compared to the rest of your skin? No? Okay. I would say maybe it's a little bit tougher. I mean, it's coarser, okay, than my skin. My skin can move around pretty easily, but my hair, I don't know, it's kind of tough. So there's more keratin inside those keratinocytes, and that just makes a hair a little bit stronger, kind of compound, right, especially as it's growing outside of your body. All right, so this whole thing is what we call a follicle, and here's the epidermis. And this really light area represents the stratum basale. And look what happens. That stratum basale dives deep down into the dermis, and then it comes back up. And that epidermis also makes this sebaceous gland, right? Because we know that most glands are made out of epithelium. Okay. Sometimes we say that, sometimes we say that a hair follicle is a reservoir of epidermal cells. What the heck does that mean? I think I want to take a look at that. All right, so here's the stratum basale, very superficial in the skin, but when it starts to make up a hair follicle, right, so this is the growing end of which is the bulb of a hair follicle. Look at the epidermis goes down way over here, then it comes way back up. So this hair follicle is deep, deep, deep down in the dermis. It's a reservoir of epidermal cells, right? Because there's the stratum basale. Let's talk about burns for just a second. And then we'll finish up next time. So burns, there are a couple different kinds of burns. First degree, second degree, third degree burns. A first degree burn is when some heat is applied to the skin, right? And it doesn't burn any of the these cells right here, but it forms an irritation so that these blood vessels in the papillae start to leak, right? And there's a lot of fluid that comes up, a lot of blood goes up into this area, so it gives this area kind of a red color. That person is really lucky that they only got a first degree burn, because none of these cells were damaged to the point to where they were killed. A second degree burn, anybody have an idea what a second degree burn kind of looks like? Yeah, you get some blisters, all right, so the temperature went deeper down into the dermis and it caused damage to these blood vessels to now they start to leak a lot of fluid, right? And that leaky fluid then forms a little blister right over here. That's a second degree burn, and somebody that gets a second degree burn is still pretty lucky. I would consider them really, really lucky, because there is such a thing called a third degree burn. A third degree burn is when the cells of the epidermis have been completely damaged and maybe even burned off to where there's charcoal up over here, right? That's a third degree burn. Doesn't necessarily have to go all the way down into the dermis. Let's just say somebody killed cells all the way to the level where I'm moving the cursor right here. Third degree burn. Is that person lucky or unlucky, would you think? Somebody with a third degree burn where these cells are dead down to where I have the cursor. That person is still lucky, believe it or not, right? Because why? Where's that? Here's the stratum basale. What do you know about the stratum basale? What's happening there? Proliferation, mitosis is taking place. So these cells way down in the hair follicle, right, of the stratum basale are still alive. Then a person with a third degree burn to this level, these cells still can repopulate the rest of their skin. Their skin can grow back because of this layer, right, that's deep down inside the dermis. That's why we call a hair follicle a reservoir of epidermal cells, right, so skin can grow back. Now, if somebody has a third degree burn that goes all the way down past the bulb of this hair follicle, now that's somebody that's really unlucky. Maybe burn all the way down to the hypodermis. What happens to their skin then? It cannot regenerate, right? So they can no longer grow skin on that part of their body because all of these epidermal cells, the stratum basale cells, are gone. And then you would need a graft, a skin graft, from some other location in your body, maybe from another animal temporarily, because what is somebody really susceptible to when their skin is gone? Dehydration and infection. Right, so they need some kind of skin, even from another animal, to help protect them from dehydration and infection. That's super, super important. And then they need another transplant from some other part of their body. All right, so that's a really good idea, that you have to know something about the layers of the skin, because that's how we diagnose pathology, how we treat different kind of pathologies, like burns, for instance. You would know how to treat various kinds of burns or other kinds of things happening, okay, inside somebody's body. All right, so that's it for today. The sign-in sheet is going around someplace. I just have to talk about maybe a couple things next time, and then we'll get into the bone chapter. So stay up on your pre-lecture reading assignments, and maybe in lab I want to see some of those, right? Because that really helps you in lecture, because you got 4 lectures every week. That means every week we're moving pretty fast, right? Okay, so every week now is like 2 weeks during the regular semester. Okay, see you guys upstairs in just a little bit.